Session number 9253, reel 20.
Mr. Jack Dorgan, reel 20. When did you actually receive your MM? When did you actually get it?
Well, I certainly didn't get it and didn't hear nothing when I was over in France and Belgium. You know, that was 1915 and 16. In fact, I don't think it was after the war or the... No, the last... No, sorry. I received it. I received the MM. Actually, it came through the post about 1917. I was home. I was home, not married, on what we call Class W.
Was that the first you knew of getting the MM?
Yes.
What was your reaction? Were you pleased or...?
No, I mean, it was just something. Well, I felt I deserved it. That was all, nothing more.
You've shown me a watch here, which is presented to Sergeant J. Dorgan, MM, 7th Battalion Northumberland Fusiliers, by the public of Ashington, November 8th, 1916. So you'd received it in 1916?
Yes, when I was on Class W.
Were you, when you got back to the trenches, I mean, there's no one there at the time you immediately got back, but were you seen as a bit of a hero for having done this?
No, nobody there to say, good lad, Jack. Not a soul. I never saw nobody. And then I went back into no man's land that night because I was really, because it was still night, you see, still dark. Then I was exhausted. All I did was to creep away to where I had a dugout. I was lucky at that time, I had a dugout, and I went there, and it was midday when I woke up, that same day. It would be some time during the day when I woke up. No, it was just an ordinary episode in the war. Just had to treat it like that, you see, because life went on, and we... I had to serve my time in the trenches that time and come out on rest. And I can't even remember anybody ever saying, you did a good job.
But when you were out in no man's land, was there much activity going on? Were there incidents almost every night? Or what was the normal course of events in a night in no man's land?
There was always something going on in no man's land, you see, because... The officer commanding, each company, and we had four companies in our battalion, was responsible for all activities in the trenches, in the repair of trenches, repair of barbed wire, all the patrolling, listening posts, snipers, activities of every kind that happened within his area. Now, me, I had a free hand, and I could move from one end of the battalion, one end from number one company to number four company, as long as I let them know I was there. I was always very careful. I let them know. I didn't want anybody firing from our shot thinking I was a German. And I always, during the day, tried to get in touch with the officers in charge of each section of the trenches to see what activities he would be endeavouring to do. And invariably he'll say, well, I've got my trench to repair or my barbed wire to repair, so I'll have a working party. That was commonplace. You had working party on. And if you had a working party on your barbed wire and a working party on your trenches, you'd have a covering party also out in front of your barbed wire. So there was always activity of one kind or another in no man's land, every night.
Would the Germans be equally active in No Man's
Land? Well, I expect so. I expect so. You know, walk and see them flitting about. I could, I mean, but I wasn't there to interfere with them. And the fellas out in No Man's Land, whom the Germans weren't there, out there to interfere with it, unless they had express orders. I mean, if you found out, when I took a patrol out, you see, if we found out that the Germans were repairing their trench at a certain part or repairing the barbed wire in a certain section of the trench, we would get back ourselves and to our own trench, and the officer would put machine guns on where I had given the information. That was what our job was. Yes.
But you didn't have any fighting patrols out?
No. I wasn't there for fighting. That's how I lasted, I expect.
Were there ever any...
I don't know how long it lasted. When I look at that war book, especially written by the officers of my battalion, where we lost so many men every night in the front line.
Were there ever any raids?
Until I did get catched.
Were there ever any raids?
Any what?
Any raids, trench raids, launched by your battalion while you were there? Actual raids on the front German front line?
No, we never. You know, I don't know. No, there never been any raids that I knew of, no. No raid in the German trenches. We sort of left the Germans alone, and the Germans left us alone a good deal. Just the machine guns and the guns.
Would you have these operations in No Man's Land, even in areas near Hill 60, where you say there are only 30, 40 yards of No Man's Land? Would you still be...
But you're restricted. You're restricted then. You're in No Man's Land on Hill 60. You never was out in No Man's Land. I never knew, or I was never in No Man's Land on Hill 60 itself, only 30-odd yards, 31 or 2 yards. That's all distance between the Germans and ours. You couldn't talk. At least we kept our voices down on Hill 60, in case the Germans heard. And you see, it was 1915, mostly, that I was on Hill 60, The days before the Mills bomb. Speaking of the Mills bomb, the trenches were so near that our engineers improvised the forerunner of the Mills bomb. They were made out of the ordinary jam tin, the jam eaten empty, you filled the bottom half of the jam tin with gunpowder of some kind. And then you put a layer of clay on the top. And then the top half, but before that, you had a length of fuse wire and a fuse. The length of fuse wire would be about 14 inches long, 14 to 16 inches long, with a detonator on one end, two open ends on the other end of the wire. And you shoved the detonator, a detonator would be the size of your little finger, not as thick, perhaps, as a little finger, but as long as a little finger. You shoved it through the covering clay of the gunpowder into the gunpowder with the wire fuse hanging out. And then the top half of the tin, the jam tin, our engineers supplied us with boxes of bolts and any old piece of scrap iron, and we filled the whole of that up. And then we had tape which fastened down the lid of the jam tin, and that was a jam tin bomb.
Did the Royal Engineers show you how to make these, and then you would make them yourselves?
Yes, yes. We were shown, first time or two, how to do it. The engineers, one of them would come up, or a party would come up into the trenches and give us some of these, you know. And then after that, they would supply, we supplied our own, and they supplied the gunpowder and the fuse wire and fuse. Now then, you had to light the fuse wire, as I said, about 14 or 16 inches long. And me, when I used them, we always used to do practice when we were out western, by the way. We used to do practice in throwing these jam tins. But, you know, when you were back western, you had the open air. But when you were in the trenches, you didn't have that facility, because you putting your hand over, your arm over behind you in a trench, well, I mean, the trench is only about 2'6" or 2'9" wide. Oh, it was a difficult job to throw a homemade bomb, you know, at the Germans. You couldn't get very accurate, you know. And then also, the biggest burden of all, of course, was you didn't know how long the fuse wire would burn before it reached the powder. That was the trouble, you see. Fuse wire, about 14 inches long, with a detonator on the end, buried among gunpowder, and you lit one end, and then you threw the darn thing at the German trenches, and then you ducked, because you didn't know how long it would take. It was said, but I never knew it, I never experienced it, that sometimes the fuse hadn't gone off and the Germans threw it back at you. But that was a tale. I don't suppose the Germans would do that. I know the Germans had them as well, you know. Oh, aye, the Germans had them as well, similar. I know if we saw one coming tumbling over, because they didn't come over evenly, you know, we got out the way as far as we could. And I expect the Germans would do the same.
When did you used to throw these bombs?
When the trenches were close, when they're near.
But what time? Would you just throw a few during the day, or did you throw them at night? Or when did you actually throw them?
Oh, at night. You never did anything through the day. Daylight hours, never did anything through the day. War was suspended during the day in daylight hours.
And so you just throw, when there was nobody, no British in no man's land, well, you just throw them at the German trenches?
We sometimes threw them from no man's land, if you were, you know, near enough. Yes, you could lob them. You could lob a one if you were out in no man's land, if it was wide enough in between the Germans and you. Depends on circumstances.
So besides your knob carry, you sometimes take how many of these bombs with you? Would you take many or...?
No, not very many.
How would you carry them in no man's land?
Well, you just had carried them in your hand. You just had the two, no more. You didn't carry them in any pockets, no fear. They're too dangerous. At least we thought. We didn't like them. No, we didn't like them. That was late 1915 when we had those. And then before the end of 1915, the modified Mills bomb came into operation. They were the forerunners of the Mills bomb. You know what the Mills bomb is, of course. A Mills bomb, you could hold it in your hand. It's just short of the size of a jam tin. But the outside is made of steel, segregated, so that when it exploded, all the outside shell, which is segmented, would divide into shrapnel, pieces of shrapnel about the size of your thumbnail. And how it was detonated was the detonator was inside the Mills bomb at one end, and there was a loop which it was held down by a pin, on the Milsbaum, and you do this pin out, and that release the piece that came over, and that ignited the doings inside. You only had a few seconds. I don't know how long the Mills bomb was. I never trusted them, actually. I had too much experience of the old Jamtin bomb, and you didn't know very much about them. They were dangerous to handle, and we consider the Mills bomb in the same category, very dangerous to handle. As soon as this loop was released, that ignited inside the Mills bomb, and within a few seconds it could explode.
Did you know of any accidents with either jamming?
Oh yes.
Can you tell us about what sort of thing happened?
Well, we'll get spattered with the old jam tin one, the most dangerous of them, you know. Yes, men would get their faces and their bodies spattered with shrapnels, the Mills bombs. I don't remember much about the Mills bomb, any reactions from Mills bombs. I'll say that for them. But we had many accidents from the jam tin homemade bomb.
Did you often go bombing when you were in no man's land?
Not me, no. There was a recruited, when I was in 1915, they recruited men from the battalion for bombers, to be bombers. And what they did, but I don't know, bombers, yes. And they recruited men to be, to dig tunnelers. I never volunteered for any of them. I was quite happy to be in the job I had. I was very happy in the job I had. I had I was just a young fella, 21, 22, full of life, being strong. And I enjoyed the life I did in no man's land.
Would you be told, when the bombers were formed, the bombing teams were formed, would you be told what they were up to as well?
No, they were just taken away, twinned separately.
Did they not come back while you were still there?
No, I never met any of them.
You say that when the... at a place like Hill 60, where the trenches were very close, that people didn't go out into no man's land, how then would they manage to do the repairs on the wire and the trench that needed covering parties? What would happen about that?
No barbed wire. The barbed wire was just loose barbed wire in no man's land on Hill 60. There was no barbed wire, as I've explained it to you, there on Hill 60.
So that would just go by the board?
Well, couldn't do anything else.
What about repairs to the actual trench? There'd be repairs...
Yes, they were done. Oh, yes, you did them. Oh, yes, but you had to.
You wouldn't have a cover.
Oh, yes, but, you know, it was most dangerous because many times machine guns kept your head, made you keep your head down, you know. And I was sometimes way up in Hill 60 in those areas like that, which were very near each other. There was gaps, which when you crossed, you know, instead of going along a trench, there suddenly there was a gap where a big gun had been on the trench and shot at the trench. Oh, dangerous job altogether, yes. But the Germans were in the same position, you know.
So there wouldn't be a covering party out at all.
No.
The repairs would be done from inside the trench.
No, nothing like, no covering parties, no. You see, when I was talking about covering parties, linen posts and all that, that was where you had some distance between the two trenches, the Germans and ours.
Are there any other places you were at that you particularly remember or had characteristics that you can recall?
Oh, yes. I was the village of, what do they call it now? That's a fitness name. Trenches, generally, as I said before, they went around villages and, of course, around towns. But there was one village up in the Ypres salient, which went through the village. they actually went through where the houses, the cottages were. I don't know the size of the village. I don't know where the road through the village was or anything. I only know that our front line was in among houses, cottages, and so were the German front line in among houses and cottages. And as I've been on my own, allowed to do anything I like, I used to use the daylight hours to explore and see what was happening, so that when darkness came on, I could move a bit more freely. Now, in this village of Hooge, some of the trenches went through the cellars of the village, and creeping through a long one in the daylight, I came to a cellar, and at the far end of the cellar, I looked and looked, and I heard voices. And on the other side, when I went along the cellar wall, I could look down into the German trench. And in the German trench was five Germans. There was an NCO, obviously, with his stripes and that kind of thing. I didn't understand. They were in blue uniform, three of them, two ordinary private soldiers, and one non-commissioned, what we in England, in the English army, called NCO. But there was two in ordinary clothes, ordinary civilian clothes, two young fellas. Well, that rather astonished me. Five Germans in the trench, two in civilian clothes, two privates and an NCO. Oh, I couldn't get out of those trenches fast enough to report what I had seen. It was the fact that two civilians were in that German trench that was remarkable to me. So I went down to battalion headquarters and reported it to the colonel, who passed it on to brigade headquarters. And the next day I was sent for. I went down to battalion headquarters, and this was during the day, and there was an officer, a real brass hat, we called them. And he introduced himself to some major from British headquarters. And they were interested in my story of the five Germans in the trench in Hooge village. I said, well, they're to be seen yesterday. I haven't seen them today. He says, well, I'm going up with you to see them for myself. I says, you're not going up like that to this major. Not with me. Brass hat, polished buttons, and polished, you know, on his hat and so on. Spotless he was. Spotless. And we were all trench warfare. He says, that's easy. So he took his jacket and his hat off, and he went up in his shirt sleeves with me. And I took him into that cellar, took him to the wall, which overlooked the German trench, and there they were. This was the next day. There they were, as usual, pottering about inside the trench. Two privates, an NCO, and two fellas, quite young fellas, 20 or 22 year old, in civilian clothes. They saw them for himself. This headquarters officer from I don't know where from. He was very pleasant. So when we finished, he had an escort with him. And he says, perhaps the sergeant, me, will join me in my lunch. That was the best part of the thing. He had some lovely sandwiches. White bread. And we didn't have any white bread, you know. At that time, the bread we had was sort of oatmeal type. Oh, Lord. I don't know what kind of meat was in the sandwiches, but I thoroughly enjoyed the sandwiches. He went off, and that was... I never heard another word. Just another episode in trench warfare.
How far apart were the trenches at Hooge?
Oh, I couldn't tell you.
Was this German?
Yeah, you just went back. As I said, you see, the German trenches were just over to the other side of the wall, and we were at this side. Oh, I don't know.
This was during the day, was it, this particular exploit?
Yes. Oh, yes. Both times.
Why did you not throw a bomb at them or something like that?
No fear. They throw the one back at me. Oh, no. No, I was astonished at the fact that there was two civilians there, you see. And he didn't, this officer, sitting having no sandwiches, he was a nice, decent sort of fella, you know. But I said, you couldn't have gone in like that with it. You're sitting with his tunic open, you know, and brass buttons or gold buttons or whatever they were.
But I presume there was plenty of cover if you were moving in no man's land in the day, in Hooge, with the ruined buildings.
Oh, yes. Well, it was the buildings half up, you see. There was no buildings, you see. I mean, if a cottage was shelled, there was all the stones and bricks and things, you see. And for to move from one part to another, you had to shift stones and bricks to get through. Oh, yes. Oh, that was at Hooge.
When were you at Hooge, then? Can you pick which part of your time? What dates were you at Hooge?
Very late in 1915, somewhere about November or so.
You were at Hill 60 at Christmas, were you, 1915?
Yes. Not 1916, 1915, when I was on Hill 60. Why it sticks in my mind is the English newspapers made a lot of fuss about Christmas Day coming and hinted that in some parts of the front line, the Germans and the British would be celebrating Christmas Day with each other. Well, nothing like that happened where I was. On Hill 60, 1915, on Christmas Day, nothing happened at all. I remember it perfectly because it was a grey, dismal day. Light wasn't too good, and there wasn't a sound from the German trenches. We were very subdued because it was Christmas Day and nothing was happening. And Christmas Day was very much in our minds, in our trenches, in the front line, with the Germans only less than 40 yards away. We never did, as the English newspaper said, we would be doing exchange Christmas greetings with each other. Complete silence the whole of the day. But nobody ever, from our lines, fired a shot. We just took it as a day when we ignored the fact that we were in the trenches. And the Germans in their trenches must have done the same, because there was not a sound happened there on that grey, dismal day. It didn't rain. There was no snow.